Hi, I'm Spider Robinson. Welcome to Thrillin' at the Macmillan, a series of 8 essays about space and space travel that I wrote during my term as the first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. These essays were posted over a 9-month period at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenter.com, and I'll be reading them aloud for you in this podcast series. These essays are podcast under Creative Commons license with the conditions no derivatives, non-commercial, and share alike. Thrillin' at the Macmillan, number 8. Space Generation. Copyright 2006 by Spider Robinson. The first thing Space Generation makes me think of is the quantum ramjet, a hypothetical star drive I chose as the motive force for the starship Charles Sheffield in Variable Star, my new collaboration with Robert A. Heinlein. It would make use of quantum fluctuations in the energy of the cosmic vacuum to propel a ship up to relativistic speeds quickly without burning any fuel. Don't ask me how, I might answer. No such engine has been built yet, but the engineer who proposed it, David Froning, mentioned parenthetically that if a quantum ramjet were ever built, it might very well create new universes every second it was in operation as a side effect. It's kind of hard to top that for Space Generation. You think you got problems with your exhaust emissions? Thinking about the quantum ramjet gets me thinking about a whole other kind of space generation, though. And it's that one I think I'll focus on in this, my final essay here. The spectrum of generations of the people who showed up at the Space Center's auditorium on Saturday evening, May 26th, to hear me and roboticist Guy Amiga, engineer Ray Maxwell, physicist Doug Beter, and astronomer Jamie Matthews, my science advisors for Variable Star, explain the nuts and bolts of starship design, planet construction, and star demolition, and discuss Robert Heinlein's dream of mankind spreading out through the stars, getting wiser and kinder as it goes. I think of myself as a member of the first space generation, and I saw many of my contemporaries out there in the audience. We were the very last kids ever to be laughed at by our teachers and elders for believing that men would walk on the moon one day. I also observed a few survivors of the real first space generation, the one slightly before mine, that was actually putting men in orbit and bringing them down alive when I was in short pants. The generation I expected to see least represented was the one that immediately followed mine, the poor in-betweeners. They came just after the first great push into space, and most never did quite get what it had been all about. They arrived just before the next great push into space, which is now finally beginning to gather strength, and the ones that showed up that night were among the few of that cohort who really get what that is going to be all about, namely, the long-term survival of their species. This was the generation that had no problem with the U.S. government burning, not digitizing or even microfilming, burning all the blueprints and specs for the Apollo launch vehicle, the stupendous vessel that put men on the moon, to save storage space. This is the generation that was okay with destroying or selling for scrap all the stockpiled parts, the special pumps and one-of-a-kind valves, parts machined to incredible tolerances, the most sophisticated tools ever built by bald apes. Why not? The space race was over, wasn't it? We won. Time to chill, Buck Rogers. I can't really blame them. They were grossly misinformed and misled by their journalists, their politicians, and their movie makers, who persuaded them space had nothing to do with them and their lives. We science fiction writers continue to do our best as always, but by and large we got drowned out.
People who read books, next on Geraldo.
To our horror, as Hollywood blurred the lines it didn't even realize existed between science fiction and fantasy, readers migrated en masse from Lazarus Long and the Ship Who Sang to Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings. As our society was coming for the first time to depend utterly on science and technology for its very existence, we perhaps understandably got sick of hearing about it, weary of all the thinking it called for. And despite all that, there were about as many members of that age group present in the Macmillan Space Center auditorium that night as any other, an encouraging sign. I think of myself as just entering my golden years. I always have, since about 15 minutes before I was born in 1948. But when my friend Isaac Asimov was once asked by a journalist to settle an argument on just when the real golden age of science fiction had been, he smiled and said, 13. And I saw more than a few of Isaac's kind of golden ager out there in the auditorium Saturday night, too. Bright, alert, smart, concerned, aware teenagers, and even a few preteens who believe the future can be improved, and who think thinking is the way to do it, and who are ready, as Ted Sturgeon said, to keep on asking the next question. If we can average 2 or 3 of those per high school, we can save the world. No question in my mind. I cannot tell you how much hope and joy it gave me to see that crowd and hear the questions they had. Not just the young'uns, either. Their presence was the most exciting and reassuring, but what gassed me most of all was the span of ages. No age group was unrepresented. The only other event I have seen with such a multi-generational audience in years was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Freedom of Speech Tour last summer. All my friends and I had to give our crowd for entertainment last week with science facts and PowerPoint presentations, but they too seemed to leave happy. Age is irrelevant. The only requirement for interest in space and space travel is brains. Reading the paper or Time these days, watching network or cable TV, listening to commercial radio, it can become very difficult to believe there are any brains left in North America. I think that is why the Macmillan's brilliant executive director, Donna Livingstone, has been making such a concerted effort over the past few years to redefine and reimagine the Space Center, striving to make it more relevant to, quote, put the planet back in planetarium, unquote, to reach out as widely as possible for people with brains of all ages, and try to get them all talking. I suspect it's why, for instance, she dreamed up the novel idea of a writer-in-residence at a planetarium in the first place. Don't ask me how she sold it to the Canada Council. Even science fiction can't explain everything. Thanks to Donna, I'm recording myself reading aloud the 8 essays I've published on the Space Center's website so far and making them available as podcasts here, with other podcasts hopefully to follow in future. That gives the Center a shot at reaching the visually impaired or print-challenged, as well as little kids with brains who haven't finished teaching themselves to read and write yet. I won't be surprised if before too long this website has a videos page, too. Science is slowly getting hipper. The signs are all around. It's railroading time for space enthusiasts. The cover of this month's Wired magazine depicts dozens of spacecraft launching at once. The accompanying story is called Rocket Boom. It took long enough, but finally billionaires like Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk are tripping over each other in the race to become the first space trillionaire. And that much money pressure can change history. Always has, in fact. It might even be in time. The only practical hope I see of solving our planetary ecology problems is exploitation of space. We simply have to stop meeting our energy needs and our materials needs by ripping both of them up out of the ground. There is free power in space 24/7, 365, waiting only to be collected and distributed. There are free metals and minerals in the asteroid belt waiting only to be collected, processed far from the environment, and landed as consumer goods. There are steps we can take from space to globally control our planet's weather cheaply and efficiently. Guy Amiga, a writer himself, is at work on a novel right now explaining how. Everything we need to save ourselves is a few hundred miles above our heads. To get there, in time, we need the second space generation to inspire it and to push for it. What Donna Livingstone, Raylene Marchand, Lisa McIntosh, Erica Korstrom, and all the rest of the Space Center staff are doing, and the response that's been coming back, help persuade me that the second space generation is indeed forming even as we speak. I sense their efforts are making the place a genuine space center in more than just name, a locus and a focus for everyone in the Pacific Northwest who's smart enough to realize that our real salvation lies not in the heavens, but in the stars. British Columbia may well end up remembering Harvey Reginald Macmillan for his planetarium long after anyone recalls what Mac Blow was or what an Order of Canada meant. I am honored and grateful to have been a part of that. And as my residency now officially draws to a close, I'd like to thank the entire staff and board of the H.R. Macmillan Space Center, and especially Donna, for allowing me this opportunity to use their soapbox. I'll continue to work with the board and in other ways, and of course I'll keep writing optimistic science fiction stories about people who solve their problems by applying their brains. And with any luck, by the time we have our first official Space Center party in orbit, they'll still be letting me drink champagne. Leave them with a song, they say. To help me promote Variable Star, my friend David Crosby kindly contributed a tune to some lyrics I had written into Chapter 1. I hope to do a full-scale professional studio recording of it someday down the line. All I'll need is a lot of spare time and money. And when that happens, perhaps I'll find the nerve to ask David to sing harmony. In the meantime, the best I can offer you once I've signed off this podcast series is an impromptu live performance of the song my wife Jeannie and I did last October for Jeff Cavanaugh on WTBBL, the splendid Seattle radio resource for the blind and print challenged. The recording is rough, imbalanced, muddy, and monaural, but gee, I love those harmonies. Thank you very kindly for reading and or listening to these essays. Now, go invest in a telescope or a spaceship, if you haven't already, so you can get started on your own way to the stars. BC writer Spider Robinson has published 33 books since 1973 and won the International Hugo Award 3 times so far. For further information, visit www.spiderrobinson.com or www.variablestarbook.com. This has been Thrillin' at the Macmillan number 8. The last in a series of 8 essays about space and space travel written during my term as first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. Some relevant links can be found at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenter.com. Thanks for falling by. I hope you'll come back for the rest of the essays. This is Spider Robinson, still thrilling at the Macmillan. PayPal or Visa donations are most welcome. Just click the link on the podcast page at my website.